Hi, I'm Cassie McCullough and welcome to The List, RN's weekly slice of reality, popular culture style.
And I'm Jason DeRosso, and today, behind the scenes in reality television.
Don't put your head down the table and roll your eyes like you are like, whatever.
That's your perception. That's the way you decided to perceive things.
You've got like personality disorder or something, or just lack of manners.
Oh my God. I'm not doing anything. That is what you think I'm doing. It's not the actual case.
We'll meet two insiders who've produced and directed some of Australia's most watched shows.
And selfies at funerals. This online gallery of pics pokes fun at millennials documenting themselves on the most somber of occasions. But the size of the trend suggests they're more than just insensitive gaffes.
That's coming up on The List.
Well, to that intriguing look behind the scenes of reality television in just a moment. But first, to something that really has taken your fancy this week, Jason DeRosso.
It absolutely did. It's this new site called, it's a Tumblr site called Selfies at Funerals. Now, we've spoken about selfies before on this show. They're those ubiquitous self-portraits taken with smartphones usually. They're normally kind of taken with a triumphant pose. You're showing off maybe a new hairstyle or a new outfit. This site, Selfies at Funerals, has caught the media's attention because it's a collection of selfies taken predominantly by teenagers at funerals. And it's been described as the height of bad taste, but also it's rather funny as well, inadvertently so, I guess. Now, one shot in particular shows a boy smiling into the lens and over the shoulder.
In the background.
We can see the open coffin and you can see his deceased grandmother. Oh. It's rather kind of unfortunate, really. It makes you think that half these selfies are innocent gaffes, but then again, they may also signal a deeper shift in online sensibilities.
Well, you've managed to track down the curator of this website, Selfies at Funerals. He's joining us now.
He is indeed on a cell phone from New York. His name is Jason Pfeiffer, and he's also senior editor at the Business Innovations magazine, Fast Company. Hi, Jason.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me.
Jason, what are you actually documenting here, do you think? Because as I say, these photos are offensive for some people. For other people, they're just kind of funny.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that for the kids who are taking them, they're probably something else entirely. They might be, like a sort of real expression of grief for them. It was funny how you described them as possibly a gaffe. And there are so many of them that you have to think that something more than just a sort of continuous, repetitive error is being made. I think that this is ultimately, every kid has a camera phone, and not just kid, everybody has a camera phone in their pocket at this point, and you have an urge, sort of feeling like a need to just document yourself everywhere you are, and I think that that extends to the places that we would have previously never thought to document ourselves.
So are you saying there's a kind of honesty about these pictures?
Oh, that's funny. I mean, perhaps. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but I suppose, every kid is at some point pretty bored in a funeral, and this is definitely their sharing to the world of that boredom. I don't think that necessarily this is an honesty, though I guess maybe it is, it's so much as it is an unfilteredness. I really think that kids, everybody, but kids in particular, are still trying to figure out what the boundaries are between what's worth sharing and what's not, and that still extends into fairly uncomfortable places.
Well, maybe there's also something in this of, that element online where, in terms of online culture and the way certainly it's developed with social media, that unless you post it, it kind of hasn't really happened. And this might extend to things like funerals. But I kind of mean that seriously too,
Yeah, I think that's a little true. I mean, how odd to think of it, right? Like, grandpa didn't die unless I took the selfie. But I think that kids do have a sense that they need to sort of mark that they were somewhere. It's the way that they share. It's the way that they tell each other about what they were doing. And I don't, they of course don't mean it to be as public as I've made it, right? It is public, and they posted it on social media for everybody to see, but their real intention was just to sort of show it to their friends, and they hadn't thought about how it's been kind of sitting there on the internet in perpetuity.
Mm. there is some kind of criticism, I guess, inherent in your Tumblr site and one I feel myself. But I also wonder, is there anything actually wrong with these images at all? And I'm reminded of the Victorian era practice of the post-mortem photograph, and also of the artist Andre Serrano's photographic series. He's the guy who did that controversial Piss Christ work. But he also did a series called The Morgue of very... Well, they were described as classically beautiful photographs of dead people. I mean, maybe this is just a trajectory of a pre-existing tangent of art.
I think that could be entirely true, and the Victorian photos are something that I really thought about as I was putting this together. But, you know, I'll tell you what I think the connection between the selfies and the Victorian photos, which are amazing, and if your listeners haven't seen them, you should just go Google, and it's like these photos of people with, like, you know, dead mom propped up on a chair, and they're all taking photos with her. And, you know, it was their exploration of use of a new technology, right? They were figuring out how to sort of cross-reference death with technology, and that's really the same thing that these kids are doing today. And just as, I think, when you look back at those Victorian photos, and they just seem creepy and weird, the selfies today just feel kind of creepy and weird. Is it wrong? No, I don't necessarily think so. I mean, certainly a lot of people do, and the reaction, the dominant reaction to this site has been, you know, oh, you stupid kids, you self-important kids, and I don't think it's that. I really try to not make the site come off as judgmental, though I realize it totally comes off as judgmental, but I didn't write any.
Well, there are some pretty bizarre pictures. I mean, this one photo I saw of a particularly busty teenage girl in a bikini posing with her grandmother's ashes,
having a day in the sun with Nana.
What's interesting about that is that, I mean, not all of them are actually pictures with corpses. They're often just on funeral day taking a picture of the outfit or whatever. And it strikes me that they're trying to almost take the edge off the emotion of the day by taking a photo of something that's almost banal, like, I'm at the funeral, but look at my hair. I'm at the funeral, but look at my outfit.
Right. That is totally true. And the selfie that I think reflects that the most is that girl who wrote something like, I love the way my hair looks, hate why I'm dressed up, you know, because she's at a funeral.
Yeah, funeral.
Right, exactly. But, you know, I had, when I made this, the first thing I did was just to send the link to a couple colleagues. And, you know, one of them, who's a young guy, admitted that he had actually taken a selfie in the car on the way back from his grandpa's funeral. And he surmised that this could be a coping mechanism for kids. Exactly what you're saying, that it's sort of moving your mind and your focus off of the sort of somber event, and just kind of trying to capture something that might be a little more positive, like how your hair looks.
Yeah. I noticed there was a piece in Flavor Wire by Tyler Coates suggesting that maybe it's unfair to single out teenagers for this kind of perhaps narcissism. And in fact, over the weekend after the death of Lou Reed, that the amount of people posting their grief on social media was almost a kind of similar display of the performance of grief. And just because they weren't holding, this is what he says, just because they weren't posting a selfie holding a vinyl copy of Transformer doesn't mean it wasn't a tad bit self-serving. What do you reckon about that?
That's funny. I hadn't seen that. You know, it's true. I've made two Tumblrs that have really taken off that have both been primarily about kids taking photos at awkward or inappropriate moments. And
yes,
and
the other Tumblr was called Selfies in...
Serious Places.
Selfies in Serious Places, yeah. And, you know, both times people react to it thinking that it's a condemnation of millennials and their sort of self-servingness. And I honestly don't see it that way. I mean, I realize that it comes off that way, but I really don't see it that way. I do think that this generation just happens to be the generation that, grew up with this technology for the first time. And I think that had my parents' generation or my grandparents' generation been the generation that was given this technology when they were kids, they would have done similarly stupid and uncomfortable things. It's not about these kids. It's really just about youth and new uses of technology.
Well, it should also be noticed that you do give many of the people that you feature on both these sites the right of reply, and you've really started a conversation, I think.
Yeah, I really hope that I've done that. I did not have such pure intentions. My intentions were just to make something that was kind of funny and said something about internet culture and the way that people, you know, might overstep the bounds. And I do really love that these Tumblrs start a kind of broader conversation about culture in general. And I think that's really healthy and good that we look at the way that people use technology and what they're tweeting out and think about what it says in a broader means. And when those kids started replying directly to me, which is not something that I anticipated or that I was originally asking for, but once they started doing it, I really felt a responsibility and obligation to just kind of let them say their piece, because people are making fun of them now. I mean, I guess I was making fun of them, but people are making fun of them, and I think that they have every right to be able to chime in as well, and they should do it on the site that everyone's looking at.
Well, Jason, you've certainly, along with these kids, made a fascinating contribution to the ongoing conversation of how we live online now. The site is Selfies at Funerals. Jason Pfeiffer, thanks for joining us on the list.
Thanks, Jason.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Jason Pfeiffer, the curator of Selfies at Funerals and also senior editor at the business innovation magazine Fast Company.
On RN, this is The List. I'm Cassie McCullough, and with me is co-host Jason DeRosso.
And now to reality television, which has proven enduringly popular, despite criticisms that its trashiness appeals to the lowest common denominator. And far from being a cheap option for creating hours of programming, these days reality TV involves very highly produced shows which command massive budgets and big crews. And when the formula and the timing is right, they can capture the attention of the nation. This week, the grand final of The X Factor peaked with more than 3.5 million viewers across the nation. So what does it take to make a successful and highly lucrative reality TV series? And what is reality television anyway? To help us work out these and other issues around reality TV are two experts, Kate Douglas-Walker, a reality television director who worked on 7 series of Big Brother in the UK before coming out to Australia to help launch MasterChef. She's since gone to take MasterChef to a number of countries, from Turkey to India. And most recently, she's been involved with The X Factor, Celebrity Apprentice and The Mole. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, great
Hi.
To have you.
Thank you.
And also joining us on the line from Melbourne is Josie Mason-Campbell, a TV producer who's now managing executive producer at Foxtel, the company which has commissioned what will surely be an Australian reality TV classic next year, The Real Housewives of Melbourne. Josie has also worked on My Restaurant Rules and been executive producer of Australia's Next Top Model, that show that grabbed headlines when one of the judges accused a group of contestants of bullying and gave them a memorable nickname, the Dapto Dogs. G'day, Josie.
Hi, Josie. Hello, Jason. How are you doing?
Good, good. Now, both Kate and Josie are going to give a presentation called Who is the Real Director in Reality Television at the upcoming Australian Directors Guild Conference. We're very happy to have you here with us. Kate, first to you, you helped set up Australian MasterChef, and essentially you helped turn what was a fairly modest UK show into a sexier, much more kind of vibrant, more dramatic TV series in this country. What did you set out to do?
I think the show in the UK was worked in the UK for a small audience. It was a show, it was quite simple. But what we wanted to do with the Australian version was to Uber it. That was one of the key words that we talked about. And so with that, you're talking about taking something like a top 100, so taking a load of people, putting them into an enormous room and creating a spectacle. And that was one of the key words that we used as well. So it's all about a big moment of television. And that's to do with presentation, and it's also to do with creating a big moment and an exciting presence for the viewer.
So it was that sort of cavernous set that you had, and the crane movements of the, you know, the camera
exactly
zooming in,
right.
And that very dramatic music.
Yeah, I mean, I think the music is a big player in MasterChef, and I think that's been used across lots of different programs since. But also, I do think that, you know, we shot in a massive warehouse, and I think that again has been used in a lot of programs since. So I think we set the style with MasterChef, and, you know, blow my own trumpet somewhat, but I think we set the style for a lot of those bigger shows.
Josie, how are the participants selected? I mean, do you always go for the most extreme personalities?
I think that in the past, perhaps people have gone for extreme characters. When reality TV was first breaking into Australia, it was the easiest thing to do. But as the genre has sort of progressed and, dare I say, matured, I don't think that that's something that we do anymore. I think you have to be very clever in your casting and get a group of people with a range of personalities and a range of backgrounds, a range of, you know, socioeconomic groups and histories. But I think that our audiences, particularly in Australia, are more intelligent and they deserve a more complexity in their television. So it's not enough now just to go for large, over-the-top characters. You have to be clever in your casting and you have to give the audience a better diversity and more of a range that represents the real Australian culture.
Kate, you've worked on several series of the Big Brother franchise in the UK, which is a franchise that, you know, redefined what fly on the wall meant. I mean, I don't know how many cameras you have in the Big Brother house, but there must be dozens.
Yeah, there's somewhere around 40 in the UK, yeah.
How do you find and locate the drama when there must be so much that you just need to leave on the editing room floor? What are you looking for? And can you predict when the drama is going to happen?
I don't think you can. And I think that's why you have to have, you know, two streams of footage being recorded at any one time. And that's being recorded 24/7 over in the UK over 12 weeks. Obviously, you're looking for, in the UK, it's like 24 minutes out of 24 hours. And that is a big ask. And so it's down to the individual producer, whoever's cutting that show. And I think that's an interesting point. It's down to the individual. And they represent the viewers at that point. But their idea of a good story, a great storyline, might be different to the next person.
But does the casting help you a lot?
Yeah, of course.
With something like Big Brother, like, you'll know who the big personalities are. You'll know where the tensions are likely to emerge.
That's right. And I think looking at Big Brother as a model that, you know, as you said, is a forerunner to a lot of the other reality shows that we've now got, Big Brother's simple. It's just about personality. It's actually almost a socioeconomic
experiment.
Thanks, yeah. Josie. And so, you know, with that, you're just looking at character. It's only character driven, whereas something like MasterChef or Model or any of the other, there's another facet to it. So somebody's got to be a good cook as well as being a larger-than-life person.
When it comes to the really big appeal reality TV shows, they tend to be the contestant-based ones, you know, like Big Brother or like the cooking shows. What are we looking at here? Are we looking at reflections of ourselves in the contestants? Are we looking at people who we'd rather not be or people who we aspire to be?
I think there's a mixture. I think we're looking at a constructed reality anyway. And as Josie can talk about a bit better than me, probably, that's to do with the casting process and to do with what you put into the melting pot. But I think in terms of us watching it, I mean, say MasterChef, for example, we absolutely wanted to create a positive programming experience for people. It wasn't about any more, you know, the kind of backbiting and bitching on Big Brother, on Model, on lots of other shows. It was much more about a positive creative experience for people.
Josie, it's quite interesting what happened on the last, and I know neither of you worked on this, but the last My Kitchen Rules, for example, that went to air, that became a high watermark for bitchiness on TV. And I thought that was interesting. That was no longer about the cooking, but that was about the jibes behind people's backs that contestants were sort of flinging across the table. What's that doing? That's just a soap opera, isn't it?
I have to say, because, and Kate's probably the same, because we work in television, we never have time to watch television. So I didn't actually watch that last series of My Kitchen.
Kate, you did though, didn't you?
I'm slightly guilty, in especially because at the time I was pregnant, so I was at home quite a lot. And I really like MKR as a brand. I think to begin with, it I found it slightly insulting that they'd ripped off a lot of MasterChef, but you know, you have to just take that as a compliment, I guess. But I think I was slightly disappointed in that series in terms of it just became almost farcical, and it was all the backbiting. And you actually, as a director, I felt like I couldn't see the food. And that, well, see, to me really is a bit of a shame.
As a viewer, I really love the bitchiness, I must say.
Well, that sense of competition which you're talking about, which is the crux of all of these shows, when you've got a prize dangling there that everyone wants and people are competing for it and they really want it, you are going to get, you know, competition brings out the worst in all of us, I think, you know, as we fight to get what we want. And that sort of helps encourage and amplify all those characters. And it also tells you a lot about character, you know, how people handle that competition and how they handle the high stakes.
But, Josie, you're responsible with overseeing, I'm not sure if that's the right word, but as EP at Foxtel, I guess it is, the next instalment in the Real Housewives of franchise, which is now moving to Australia. So we're going to have the Real Housewives of Melbourne. Now, this franchise is all about predominantly rich, pretty bitchy society women and their lives, their glamorous lives. And inevitably, they sort of, there's a lot of bitchiness here. What are we learning from this?
And just to put that in context, we're working with the production company Matchbox, who are doing a fabulous job on that franchise. That franchise is all about the cast and the characters. We've tried to, in Australia, I think Kate would agree, when we produce an international format in Australia, we always have to tweak it for Australian audiences.
Yeah.
And often you can't do a carbon copy of the format that worked for American audiences because it just won't work here. It's one thing us watching American women do that, but whether we will accept Australians working to the same level is another thing. So we've really tried in the casting of that to cast successful self-made women, a lot of them, a really interesting, diverse, complex bunch of fantastic women. But we've got a property developer in there, a woman who runs the biggest event company in Melbourne, a professional psychic who is incredibly accurate, and a woman also who runs one of Melbourne's top skincare companies, so, or skincare facilities. So we've got a really interesting bunch. I think you will see differences from the American format. But yes, that is all about how people interact. For me as a viewer, it's about being a voyeur into that world that we as people with normal paychecks don't ever get to access. So it is, you know, there's an element of that jaw gaping, oh my God, people live like this. But it's also interesting just watching people interact, I think.
Now, you're talking about the viewer perspective. How much of, how much do we as the viewers suspend our disbelief and how much do we understand and how much is the audience complicit in the kind of fantasy element of the mechanisms of the show?
That's actually a really interesting question. And we have to remember reality TV has been around for a long time now. So when, you know, we first started, and Kate could probably answer this better than I, but when she probably first started with Big Brother, they were working with people who didn't know the format. Now every contestant we have in our shows has grown up on this genre of television. They have been watching reality TV, you know, since they were 5 years old. So there are no excuses for not knowing or not understanding what they're getting into as contestants. I think there is an acceptance in some of the more constructed reality that it's set up. But what is absolutely and always real is the interactions between the contestants and what they say.
Kate, how literate do you think the audiences are in the mechanisms in the production?
I think we're all pretty savvy now. I think, and as Josie just said, one of the interesting things is when you come to a second series of a show, so whether it's MasterChef or Model or whatever, people really understand that. The next set of contestants coming in are pretty cluey in terms of what's going on, and so quite often you'll almost find them directing the show, or you know, telling the producers what they think they should ask them in an interview, which I think is interesting. But I think going back to MKR for a second, one of the things that I think is interesting is, you know, yes, it's you're not looking at a big cooking challenge. One of the things that I think is most interesting and most watchable is the interview process in all of these shows. And obviously with MKR, with MasterChef, those are totally interview driven. That's your narrative. And it's almost wallpapering over that with the challenge. And one of the things that I think is particularly well done in reality television is letting people pause or breathe or just leaving that interview slightly too long. So there's an uncomfortable moment of, and you can just tell that they've been lying. So I think that's a really clever way. And it's something that I would look at doing if I was putting a show together, is just letting things breathe.
Well, it's called giving people enough rope, I think, to,
yep.
to let them hang themselves.
Yep.
Can I just add, I actually think, because when reality TV started in this country, I was as sceptical of it as everybody. I think it has opened the audience's mind to real television. I think drama's making a comeback now, but there was a stage there where I think audiences would be much more interested in watching documentary because reality paved the way. It opened our eyes to real television, I mean, and to real people, and not to have scripted drama. And I don't think that can be a bad thing.
It does seem to be essentially about human curiosity, doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Time now for obsessions. What's the gem in the junk box this week? First to you, Kate.
Well, because it's reality television and because we're all obsessed with it, for me it has to be the X Factor final. I just loved it and I thought it was a really polished, beautiful piece of programming. I was part of the show way back in the audition process and it just felt like a really nice roundup of some extremely good talent.
Do you think that Demi's got a career ahead of her?
Oh, for sure. For sure.
And to you, Josie?
Well, sticking with the television theme, because it's obviously, you know, once you work in that world, that is what you do. I'm becoming quite obsessed with Neil Oliver. One of the shows that we're doing for Foxtel at the moment is Coast Australia, which is going to be an absolutely fabulous show, and we've brought Neil out to host it. And
Who's Neil Oliver?
So Neil Oliver is what I would call the David Attenborough of history. He did Coast in the UK, and he also has done various different history shows in the UK. He's a Scottish historian who has got enthusiasm and energy, and he's come out and is discovering our coastline.
Oh, is this the guy with long dark hair and a snaggle tooth?
He's bringing sexy
you
back
know
to
him.
History.
You know him. That's the one.
Why have I not noticed him?
Well, you would have noticed him. He's very noticeable, and he's, you know, he's been all over the BBC, and in fact, he's coming out to do a talk with the BBC, I think in December, and we're launching Coast Australia in December, and it's a great show, and I've been spending a lot of time in the edit suite watching him, and he's absolutely fabulous. That's enough said.
Maybe we might have to get him in here for an interview.
He's fabulous talent. His knowledge of history is fantastic, but the way he's enthusiastic about it and he brings the audience into his world and he makes history accessible to the audience, I just think is fantastic.
Well, to you, Jason DeRosso, what are you obsessed about?
Well, just briefly, the new film from Ridley Scott, which releases next week, called The Counselor, scripted by Cormac McCarthy. It has a star-studded cast, and I see already that it is dividing all my colleagues in the film critic community and dividing audiences. I actually love it, but there is an extremely graphic scene involving Cameron Diaz making love to a car in this film that will no doubt launch 1,000 memes if it hasn't already. So looking forward to how that plays in Australia next week.
Well, for me, I'm obsessed with last night's episode of Redfern Now. If you haven't seen it, watch it on iView. Don't let anyone tell you about it. Don't read anything about it. Just watch it. It's fantastic.
I'll put it on the list.
Prepare to weep.
All right, well, it's time to say thank you to both our guests, Kate Douglas-Walker and Josie Mason-Campbell. Thank you to the both of you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Kate Douglas-Walker is a freelance director of reality TV, and Josie Mason-Campbell is the managing executive producer at Foxtel.
Well, that's it for The List this week. Don't forget you can check out some of the things we've talked about on our program page. Just head to the RN website and look for The List.
And you might like to leave a comment while you're there as well. Time to go. I'm Jason DeRosso.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next week.